You're listening to Small But Mighty, the podcast of the Small Nonprofits Alliance, the online hub for Australia's small charities.
Hi everyone, I'm Bianca Crocker, founder of the Small Nonprofits Alliance.
After initially working as a speech pathologist and in management roles in health and public service, Prue Ingram has worked in leadership roles in the community sector for over two decades. Currently the CEO of a CCAID project, a small international development organisation that focuses on the empowerment of women in developing countries, Prue joins us today to chat about her leadership journey and experiencing with small nonprofits.
I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people, the traditional custodians of the lands on which I live and work, and I acknowledge the traditional custodians on the lands on which you all reside and are listening to this podcast episode today.
Hi Prue, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So you began your career as a speech pathologist. What was it that sort of led you and now you find yourself in the non-profit sector?
That's an interesting question. I think basically speech pathologist is part of those helping community-based things anyway. So I started there and then moved my way through a few different places for speech pathology and then ended up in the disability sector and took on a management role there. And from there, I just sort of moved into public service, then into management of community organisations, and then into CEO positions in the international development area.
Yeah, great. You have worked with a few nonprofits, as you just said, most recently in CEO roles in international development. You worked previously at Interplast, which is a small international development organisation that provides life-changing surgery and medical training across the Asia-Pacific region. And as we mentioned earlier, you're currently at a CCAID project, which is another small international development organisation and also one of our members at Small Nonprofits Alliance. What are some of the key challenges that you think are facing small charities in the international development space compared to the larger organisations in that area?
I think there's a number of issues for smaller organisations, and sometimes they work against having those small organisations. So I think one of them is funding. So competing for various funding buckets is quite difficult when you're a small organisation. And anyone who's been involved in grant writing and applications knows that you need to put in a lot of work around that. And that is not always able to be done when you're in a very small organisation. And just to clarify, I used to think that Interplast was quite a small organisation. We had about 15 staff there. Yep. And about 160 volunteers. Working at a CCAID project, there is me 3 days a week, a program manager 2 days a week, and a couple of volunteers.
Yeah.
That's small.
Yeah, totally.
I think relative.
Yeah, and I probably should have, because I did do a bit of research back in time, I guess, with Interplast, and so it was probably a lot smaller when you started, I think, as
it
well,
was, yeah.
And then it's grown over that time. So I probably should have made that thing because, I don't necessarily think it would, you know, count as a small organisation at the moment anyway. But, yeah, I think a lot of our listeners would be able to understand, you know, even the three roles that you just talked about in a CCAID project are all part-time roles. I know the organisation that I'm on the board with, we're a small international development organisation as well, and we've got four paid staff, I think, now, and they're all part-time as well. So that's definitely a small organisation.
Mm, yes. So I think funding and being able to, compete on that stage and do some of the background work that usually results in successful funding submissions can be difficult. I think compliance requirements for a small not-for-profit are difficult, challenging.
Yeah.
For example, a CCA projects is accredited with Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
Yeah.
And while that's wonderful because it means that we have, you know, the tick of approval around our standards and compliance and things like that. We also have a lot of reporting that not in a bigger organisation you have a compliance team, or you at least have somebody who's doing that sort of work, whereas in a small organisation it's usually, and I'm talking about the CC type small at the moment, it's usually you doing all of it or cobbling it together, and so you're sort of moving from one compliance thing to another to another.
You definitely have to wear many hats, don't you, in what you in your skills, I guess. I know that, again, our general manager at the organisation that I'm with, she, we were last year, went through the ACFID process and received that. But that was a big process to go through that sort of compliance, and she managed all of that. But she's also the same person that writes grants and that does a whole bunch of other things. So there's a lot of skills crossover there, definitely.
And ACFID, the Australian Council for International Development, is also has compliance requirements to be a member, and they're quite onerous also. Not that there's anything wrong with that in any sense at all, but to continually have that sitting as a must-do behind you with all the other must-dos can be quite daunting.
Definitely.
And I think the other thing for a small organisation is getting a voice and being able to be heard. And I know that your alliance has spent quite a lot of time around how to maximise a voice, so how to get some sort of presence on social media, where do you put your efforts. You can't put them in all places. So they're probably the three things where you're competing with the larger organisations who, once again, have a department, have a strategy.
It is tricky. Thanks for that mention about we do try to put in those resources, because I guess one thing that we learn through the Alliance and through talking to our members is what these challenges are, and we try to provide resources around that to meet some of those challenges. But I think you're right, funding, and in particular raising your voice is some of the bigger ones, because a lot of those things, I think the challenge as well is that there's not a lot of resources in terms of time, but also the money that can be spent on those things. You know, we don't have big advertising budgets or big marketing budgets in small charities at all. So we've got to be a little bit creative with how we do these things.
And I think it's really easy to go down a rabbit hole in that area to get a little bit seduced by offers and things like that that don't necessarily fit that well with how the organisation operates. So, that I think that's a bit of a danger. There are so many people out there trying to sell you better services, telling you that your website's not so good, that you should be able to do better with social media, why aren't you using this tool, et cetera, et cetera. It is quite confronting at times.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously we're going through a global pandemic at the moment, which everyone is very well aware of now. And it's obviously affected millions of people around the world. It's affecting us in Australia to a lesser extent, but in particular those living in developing communities are seeming to have really, really devastating effects. How has your experience and understanding of the pandemic been impacted by the work that your organisation does with some of its community partners overseas?
So our at Assisi Aid projects, we're working in India only at the moment, and we're working in Tamil Nadu in some of the tribal villages on gender projects and a children's project. I started with Assisi, and I started in a maternity leave locum position last April, so bang in the start of the COVID experience. The main issues have been really the lockdowns in the towns and villages, and particularly for a children's project, the lockdowns of the schools, and then a lot of the work around the COVID education. It was pretty dire, really, from the start in Tamil Nadu, in the rural areas. And we did a relief distribution to about 2,500 families. And that's pretty confronting when you are providing people with, you know, a bag of rice to help them get by, some masks, some soap, and hoping like hell that it's going to help tide them over to get through the lockdown. Of course, we now realise that the lockdown is continuing in India, and it's sometimes a little bit hard to know from the reports, what comes out from the government and what is actually happening on the ground, what the future is going to be. So it's been pretty devastating. I think it's going to have long-term, far-reaching effects, particularly for children who the organisation has worked really hard to get into education and to stay in education, and now they've had, you know, over 15 months with no education opportunities at all, except what our tutors can provide at home or via phone, because they don't have internet access. You know, it's just not possible. So I think there are going to be far-reaching implications in the future around this whole generation of children, and will they go back to school?
It is really sad, isn't it? And I think if their families of these particular children are, you know, losing loved ones and members of their families, then the ongoing effects of and pressures, I guess, on them having to stay in the labour force and work and do things like that after the pandemic is going to be really challenging as well. Like you say, to get them back into schooling and back into education. Mm. Yeah, really, really tough. It does give a different perspective to it all, doesn't it?
I think it gives a really different perspective, and, you know, anytime we complain about lockdown, it makes, you know, you just have to think of what's happening over there. You have to think of the challenges that they're facing. And really, you know, I know we keep on saying it, but Melbourne and Australia has been incredibly fortunate.
Mm, yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Definitely agree. So thinking now about your role in leadership, and I know we sort of did touch on this a little bit before, there's many things to juggle, you're wearing lots of different hats, and it's which one are you wearing in this hour, not even this day usually, because you'll be changing them regularly throughout the day. What's one of the most challenging parts specifically about leading a small team, and that may include, you know, some of the volunteers that you work with in addition to your staff, and how have you been able to overcome some of those challenges in your work?
Mm. Well, I think this has been a particularly interesting time because it has pushed us all into a lot more remote work. And so essentially I didn't meet anyone from the organisation face-to-face. In fact, I haven't met most of them. Probably met three out of all the committee of management and the staff and things like that and the volunteers. So that has changed the sort of interactions that you can have. Mm. And so that has been quite challenging, I think, in terms of that. But in terms of leading a small teams, I think it's really, like any other organisation, it's around developing relationships and developing trust, and being clear on roles and expectations, and having a really open line of communication so someone can turn around and say, I'm not feeling great today, I don't think I can do it, or, you know, checking in and being comfortable around saying, actually, I think this is the priority, what do you think? So balancing that out, I think, is really difficult. And being mindful of not giving people too much work to do in such challenging times. So while you're juggling lots of balls, you can only hurl a couple out at a time to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. And is that, would you say that the way you work with your paid staff is not that dissimilar to how you work with your volunteers as well?
I would say it's pretty similar, yeah. I think probably there's a bit more coaching with the volunteers and a bit more skill development.
Yeah,
that would probably be the main difference. But, you know, it's important to check in with people in a small team because it's very easy to get lost. While you're so busy juggling your own stuff, you can forget that other people are dealing with different issues and might be finding something particularly challenging. And, you know, yeah, I'm someone that's always had a pretty much an open door policy, and that's a bit harder to do remotely, but we try and
the remote open door.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah,
that's
step
great.
Away from the computer.
No, it is tricky, isn't it? I know different people that I've been speaking with over the past 12 months, you know, it definitely has changed our way of working, more Zoom calls, you know, and all those sorts of things, which are in some ways actually quite good. But a team that I'm working with at the moment, well, a couple of months ago, so it was maybe only 2 months ago, so it was before lockdown, this new lockdown, here in Melbourne, we were talking about just restructuring how we do Zoom meetings because they were so easy to be able to put into your diary. We just, there were some days that some of us were just having back-to-back meetings, and it's just, it's not healthy, because if you were in a usual work environment, there'd be breaks in between, or, you know, sometimes you'd have back-to-back, but you would allow time for travel or time for whatever. Whereas because you're just on a screen, you're meant to go from one Zoom screen to another Zoom screen. So, you know, I think it's interesting how it has transformed the way we work, but I think as much as it's great for so many opportunities, we do need to think about exactly what you said, stepping away. So one thing that you, or I guess that we've all been experiencing a little bit over the last 12 months or so with the pandemic, is a new level of isolation. But I know that leaders and people working in small charities, often one of the things that they report is that leaders in small charities do often feel isolated because they are not working in bigger organizations. Sometimes they're just, you know, only working with one or two other staff, or sometimes just on their own as well. How is it that you stay connected with other, not just other people and your staff, but external to that, with other small charities or with other leaders in the space?
With some difficulty, I think you could say, particularly for the last year. Prior to that, you know, it was a little bit easier because there were forums and, you know, things like the ACFID forum was a really good thing, and they did a small not-for-profits, you know, type, a small development agency thing. And ACFID have the small agency network, which is partly it. But one of the other problems about being small is being part-time. And often there are a lot of meetings, and those meetings you've got to make a decision about whether it's worth going to those meetings on your days off or actually putting some boundaries on so that you can actually work in a part-time fashion, because otherwise with a lot of part-time work it tends to bleed into other days. So, yeah, there's all those sorts of issues. Yeah. So that's difficult. When I was at Interplast, I actually joined the CEO Institute.
Yep.
And that was a really great thing to do. I mean, it obviously depended on having the budget to be able to do that. But, you know, for when you've got an organisation that perhaps is going through quite a lot of change, and it was in the early years that I was there, because I was there for about 8.5 years, then you really need some sort of solid sounding board so that you can sort of talk about things in a confidential environment. And was really great to have a whole lot of leaders from different organisations to be able to give you a different perspective on things. So while it's terrific to be involved in the development sector, I could thoroughly recommend stepping outside that if it's at all possible, because it does give you a different perspective. Otherwise you tend to go a little bit smaller in your thoughts and circles.
Yeah. And that CEO Institute that you refer to, is that from organisations of all different sizes?
Yeah.
And obviously businesses from the commercial world, and not just for not-for-profits.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of, also a great opportunity to network as well, and to get access to some different skills, either pro bono or at very low rates.
Yeah.
You know, which is all to do with building the relationships as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually, about getting outside the space sometimes. I know, you know, just even if it's speaking to a business mentor or someone like that who actually you know, who can look at things from a different perspective. And I know, you know, hopefully we're working with boards on our organisations that can bring a bit of that to, you know, support to us. But again, who do you talk to if some of your issues are with your board? You need to go external, you know. So like you said, you want to be able to have confidential conversations about whatever it is that you're going through. And I think you used the word sounding board, you know, to be able to have that externally is really important. So there's some great tips there. Thank you. So obviously there would probably be lots of rewarding aspects of the work that you do and in your leadership roles in particular. Has there been one particular highlight over the years that really stands out for you that you wouldn't have been able to have if you weren't in that leadership role?
Oh, look, there's been so many of them. It's a bit hard to talk about them. I think one of the things that's most important is being able to make a significant change and to, especially when you come in new to an organisation, to look at how it operates and if there's ways that you can maximise that by using your past experience or your networks or your connections to make it a more solid organisation. I think any time I go into an organisation, I try and get to a point where I can, as I used to say to my team, if we all, you know, won Tats Lotto or went under a bus, could somebody else walk in tomorrow and make this organisation work? It shouldn't never be dependent on a person or a personality. And we have quite a lot of personality-driven charities around, and you know, they're usually the bigger ones. But I think for the smaller ones, that's really important.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that doesn't sound like a highlight. I mean, if I was talking about highlights of my last few years in international development, I think it would probably be the work that I've done, and when I've been able to visit teams in developing countries in the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah.
See some of the surgeries that are undertaken, see some of the local surgeons learning skills that they never had before, and their absolute joy at being able, say, to repair a cleft lip for the first time in the Solomon Islands or something like that, you know. Yeah. Not an opportunity that a lot of people get to be able to experience, but, life-changing for so many.
Yeah. I think having that you know, key to what you're saying is having that connection to the work that you're actually doing, because sometimes we can get caught up in the doing and the getting of the money and the getting, you know, seeking business partnerships or whatever it might be, that we can step away for too long from the actual heart of what our organization's mission is. So, you know, that highlight for you that you just talked about in the Solomon Islands really brings that point home. And I think the other thing that's interesting is when you're talking about, you know, the personalities and things, and I don't think it's as big a challenge in smaller organisations, but what I do think is that a lot of smaller organisations, especially if they've got their founder that's sort of still involved, which is a lot of the case how they've started, just need to make sure that you are documenting things, because, again, It's tricky in those very early days for some startup charities. It's just all in that one person's, you know, all in their mind around all the processes and the work that they do. So I think there's some really great advice in there, really, or some learnings from what you've just mentioned around trying to, you know, think about how will this operate if I was not here. Let's think that it's because you won $1 million, not because you got hit by a bus.
Yeah, I think that would be better. Yeah.
So, Prue, what is your number one tip for other leaders running teams in small charities? And I know that's a big question too, just for one.
I could start 1 to 10, but no, I'll stick with one. Look, I did think about that. I think one of the important things is probably refers back to what we were just talking about, and that is that you want to make sure, even though it might feel like you don't have the funds for it, make sure that you can make the systems as efficient as possible, so you are not spending your time going backwards and forwards doing things that could have been automated with a couple of $1,000s. So you're always looking for improvements, for efficiencies, for better ways of doing things that fit the organisation and where it's up to. And I think sometimes organisations get stuck using old systems without putting their heads up to look at what else is happening around and what else they could be using, and which are incredible time savers, you know. So,
yeah,
I think systems is really important, and I think keeping the lines of communication are open. I just snuck another one in there.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you. Thank you. I guess they all relate back to efficiency, don't they? If you have good communication and great systems, your efficiency is probably improving. So we can have them as 1A and 1B.
That sounds fair.
And lastly, something that we do like to ask our guests when they come on our podcast is, what does being small but mighty mean to you?
I think what it means is that sometimes you can, by being small, you can actually achieve a lot more because you don't have to go through all the hoops. So, you know, if you work for a big charity, you've got departments and levels and managers and whatever. You want to make a change in a small organisation, you might need to check with a person, but you can actually make that change. You can have that really direct link with your partners and do some things that you wouldn't be able to do in a bigger organisation.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think it's that being able to make things happen.
Thank you so much for your time today, Prue. It's been lovely chatting to you, and it's been wonderful to have you as a guest on our podcast. So thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.